in October.
At the end of October, as a matter of fact, but before we go on, let me, we took note that the October 1, 1979 was the 30th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. And of course, tens are extremely important to the Chinese. Yet it was a very low-key celebration. The Central Committee report, which was on the evening of the actual day, and then the gathering in the Great Hall for the about 10,000 people, including the diplomatic, the ambassadors in Peking. But at an earlier time, I missed both October 1, 77 and 78 because I was in this country. Then they used to have Tiananmen packed with Chinese and displays of gorgeous fireworks and a very expensive celebration. But they cut that out because of budgetary problems. The same thing happened with May Day. It was all very low-key and relatively inexpensive.
There were also signs that the leadership was again in some disarray, wasn't it? That this Ye Jianying document had indeed awakened a certain amount of animosity. It revived issues of the Cultural Revolution precisely because it took on the issue of Mao Zedong and his legacy, how to appraise him.
But it also described the parameters in which the controversy would be fought out.
Yes, yes.
And the fact that it was unanimous and the fact that Ye made the speech, I think, was the significant of the fact that could be winners and losers in the coming argument, but there would be no totally vanquished.
Yes, but this was also the period when finally the momentum toward the elimination of Chen Qilian, and not Chen Qilian, Wu De, Wang Dongxing, Ji Denggui, and who was the fourth? Yeah, and Chen Qilian, that was right, as the fourth, was being carried out. At least that's one of the senses that I had, and that Hua Guofeng was really now in his last stages of his battle to retain the premiership.
Yes. Deng's tactic has always seemed to be to push hard and then to have a pause, a hiatus,
mm-hmm.
to let some of the dust settle before he push again for the next objective. And those pauses always gave rise to a lot of speculation that he had lost and that he was backing up and that he was losing his hold on the power center and so on.
Well, he was not pausing now. He was gathering his strength, I think, to really drive them from the ring. And again, I mean, he had made about three different efforts to do that, and this was beginning in September, the push, the third push, shall we say, to get rid of them began.
And which had as its objective the National People's Congress to take place. It so happened in about 12 months from the time we're talking about. Governor Hunt of North Carolina came at the beginning of November. He struck me as being a very competent, forceful man in full command. The
You know, it's a thought that occurred to me. I hadn't focused quite on that, but from your perspective, you really saw the next generation of American political leaders. They almost all had come to Peking while you were there.
That's right.
Who among them, and you've just commented on Governor Hunt, who among them particularly struck you?
Well, two who were, of course, quite impressive in the China setting, were not new. Our own Governor Milliken and Governor Ray of Iowa, both of whom, of course, are now stepping out, both with the same low-key style. And both very sympathetic to the connection with the PRC. For Southern governors, like Finch of Mississippi, who was quite impressive, since the almost universal rule of no immediate successorship tend to flash in the sky and then disappear unless they become president of the United States, which is not likely to happen again very quickly. And Governor Hunt, of course, was chosen to head up the commission that recommended the changes in the procedures within the Democratic Party governing the choice of the presidential candidate.
Was he going to run against Helms? He might.
It is very possible. And I think he'd Jesse Helms would have his hands full if that would happen, because I think he's a very, not only a competent governor, I think he's a very competent politician. His delegation was a tobacco delegation. It was one of the few meetings in the Great Hall when everybody was smoking. And they laid the basis then for the tobacco factory, the American tobacco factory that was established in southern China, which I guess is now fully operating.
The Philip Morris plant.
Philip Morris, and then Liggett Myers, I think, was also interested, but didn't pursue it. And the National Coal Association. They met with Kang Sharan on the same day of Friday, November 2nd, that I remember being with Governor Hunt. What's memorable about that is that Kang Sharan was talking about joint ventures, including coal production. Would they be interested, he wanted to know, helping modernize a Chinese mine or mines and be paid in petroleum? And they said yes, very much interested. But then on our side, they surprised me by saying they would also be interested in joint ventures or a compensation agreement whereby they would take it out in the product, the coal itself, asking them afterwards what we should do with that coal, sell it to Japan or on the world market. Obviously, we would not import it into the United States. But in that same meeting, Kang Sharan said for the first time in my hearing, for high Chinese official, that in these joint ventures, the foreign partner, the foreign entrepreneur, can have the right of hiring whom he wishes, the right of firing people with whom he is dissatisfied for any reason, to set his own methods of wage payment and his own rates of pay. Which I found quite extraordinary, which of course hasn't happened, but obviously he wouldn't have said these things if they were not in fact
being considered
to go to that extent. It was a very high-powered group that the National Coal Association brought over.
Well, Kang is, as we have said before, a very impressive person, too. At least I found him that way.
Yes.
Competent, quick, informed, precise.
Right. Then I opened on the 5th of November one of those endless seminars American Business were giving. This one happened to be Westinghouse. I usually didn't open them, but Westinghouse asked me if I would. And Li Qiang came back from, Minister of Foreign Trade came back from his visit to the United States. And as we were in the airport chatting, as he was waiting for the formalities of his baggage and so on, he said that he would, he was thinking of retiring. He would not be minister for many more months. As well as I remember, he was still minister.
No longer now.
No longer now, but still minister when I left.
Yes. Well, he had trouble replacing him. And his ministry became embroiled in a big bureaucratic conflict. His ministry strongly opposed many of the reforms in foreign trade, which decentralized trade.
They fought very hard on that.
And in effect, I think he stayed on to try and protect a ministry that was being torn apart as different other functional ministries acquired the ability to engage in trade directly and establish their own trading corporations.
And, of course, to some degree, they were fighting, I think, for bureaucratic turf. But they were also correct, because there were many people becoming involved with no notion of what to do and rushing into things about which they had no knowledge whatsoever.
That's a point well made, that there was a professional reason for their concern, too.
Right. I said when, in our last session, talking about the high tea which we gave for Prince Sihanouk and Princess Monique, that was the last time I saw him. That is not true. I called on the prince on November 6th, just prior to his departure on his trip to many countries. And as I remember it, I was instructed to do this based upon the reports we had made about the conversations at the high tea, to make some representations to the prince before his departure. Then, too, on that same day, gave a luncheon for John Hope Franklin, the great American historian. What's memorable about that is he was at the end of a 6-week tour, I think, where he'd given many lectures. And he said, you know, I've lectured in the Soviet Union, and Yugoslavia, Romania, Hungary. And he said, I have to keep reminding myself this is a communist country. He said, there's no feeling of it in this society. The questions that follow my lectures indicate a freedom of expression that I find really quite surprising. And he was very emphatic on that reaction to China at that time. I doubt if he'd have had such a reaction had he been there 2 years before that.
Was he there on an ICA visit?
It could have been, I don't know.
Let me ask you as we go through this another question as we proceed through your schedule and appointments. How did you decide whom to see? Did people make requests of you? Or did they go through your staff?
Sometimes a request would be made. With regard to businessmen, in the first couple of years, it was mostly direct calls. But then as calendar got more crowded and there were more there, most of the time, not always, but most of the time, it came through people in the economic and commercial section.
And were there some corporations that you didn't see, or did you try to see every leading banker, major corporate figure who came through town?
I tried to see, and I think I pretty much did see everybody who asked.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't necessarily seek them out, because most of those who came did at one time or another, either out of courtesy or a desire to get reactions to some of their proposals, would come to see us. And Wally Lanahan by this time was in charge of the econ section, and he worked very hard at making the contacts with the businessmen, bankers, and so on who came to Peking. In the diplomatic community, that was done mostly on a direct basis. For example, on the same day, the Indian ambassador Sata, who had a very brief tour and went back to become the ranking civil servant in the foreign ministry in Delhi. I had a pretty close relationship with the Narayanan first, who was the Indian ambassador when I went there, with whom I had a close friendship developed. That was not true with regard to Sata, but because of the ongoing relationship, it sort of spilled over. But I would make it a point to keep more or less routinely in touch with the ambassadors from our allied countries and so on, and then with certain others, those who were there in the ASEAN countries, and with Pakistan because he was a very knowledgeable man. Sri Lanka, there were two. The Thai who was there at an earlier time, who was a very, very brilliant person, and who went back to take a top post in the, not immediately, he went back first to be the key representative in ASEAN, and then top post in the mm-hmm. in foreign ministry. When I visited Thailand, the foreign minister came to a luncheon that Mordecai Bronowitz was giving. And he and I were both there a little early. He said to me, what do you think of our ambassador? We've been there just a short time. And so I gave an evasive answer by saying, well, I don't see as much of him as I saw so-and-so, his predecessor. He said he's a dull fellow. In fact, he's quite dumb. We're going to remove him. At the luncheon then, his predecessor came. New capacity. And we were sitting next to each other. I said, I understand your new ambassador is going to be removed. No, he said, we will not remove him. We will send out a good second man. I discovered later that the two of them had been schoolmates. He was a very nice man, but when Kriangsa came on his Peking visit, I knew more about what went on in that visit than he did, although I went over there to get a briefing. And he was such an honest man, he would say, "Oh, I don't know about that. They don't tell me." You know, any other ambassador would have covered up and have manufactured something
or
woven it around with obfuscation. Well, he said, if I queried him about something, that was discussed probably in the meetings that they wouldn't let me in.
I want to come back to the Americans that you saw, because you're very, as you recount your appointments, you saw a lot of businessmen, but you did not seem to me see quite as many on the academic side, American academics visiting. Is this because John Thompson didn't ask for the appointments, or that they didn't have any particular business? I guess it's natural, but it means that you came more in contact with the economic side of the Chinese bureaucracy than you did with, let's say, the academic side of the Chinese bureaucracy.
I had contacts with some academics that, who, for one reason or another, got in direct touch with me.
University presidents, for example.
Yes, and also some who were curious because of my past background in the United States. Well, John ran a very efficient operation, and I think tended to view it as being self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I would think most academics probably would not suggest that.
That's right.
It would be well if I saw the ambassador.
Right. University presidents. A tremendous number of university presidents were coming through at this point.
Yes.
And my guess is, although I'm not sure, but my guess is that you did not see as high a percentage of those as you did leading American corporate people. Well, with good reason, but it's just, I'm just observing.
Oh, I think I did.
You did.
Pittsburgh and Southern Cal.
Well, then I'm glad. Let's be a good.
Thursday, November 8, briefing UCLA Chancellor.
Oh, that's it. Young. Chancellor Young.
I think so.
They're very engaged in China.
And then on the next day, Major Tucker, who is the regional officer for the Marines. We get that about every 6-9 months. I think I mentioned in our last session that they'd always raise the question of when are we going to solve the problem of wearing uniforms. On this particular occasion, I remember my saying, I'm unwilling even to raise it because it's too quick. And, after subsequent visits, we did raise it, but unsuccessfully. Then on that day, November the 9th, a lecture and question and answer period at the Institute of Journalism, the Academy of Social Science. I was invited by, they had an American instructor. Would I come and give a lecture on the American labor movement? So I prepared a lecture which went from day one of the early days of the Republic, even prior to the Republic, development of trade unions, the Knights of Labor, and the FFL, and the Wobblies, and the whole bit. It took about 45-50 minutes. And lasted altogether an hour and a half. They all understood and spoke English. Although there were far, it was a far bigger group than just those in the class, because quite a lot came from Xinhua and other places. We had a couple of hundred, I guess, in the room. I was told afterwards they were astounded that I came all by myself. I was driven over, but just by myself otherwise. The first question I get, in perfect English, "Mr. Ambassador, you were the president of the United Auto Workers. You were opposed to the war in Vietnam. In your opposition to the war in Vietnam, were you expressing the will of your members, or were you expressing the position which most of them did not agree with, but which they tolerated? Or just exactly how did it happen?"
Excellent question.
A very sophisticated question. And another question was, "How did you, a labor leader, come to be appointed as ambassador? We really had a delightful time. And I made it a point, since I was speaking in English, to try and remember to speak slowly for as much comprehension as possible. And months afterwards, I was some Chinese Academy of Social Sciences asked me if I remembered that session. I said yes. He said, "Do you remember we recorded it? And we asked you, could we use it? And you said yes. We have used copies of that all over China in our teaching of English."
Is that right? It's because you spoke so beautifully.
Well, spoke slowly, and because I was speaking slowly, probably with better syntax than otherwise. And I've got a high tea down on the 20th of November.
We just have one. They must have canceled.
Right.
Leonard has looked through his date book and found that his high tea with Prince Sihanouk occurred on November 20th, not as originally scheduled and noted in his date book on October 10th. And evidently it was postponed or delayed.
So when I said a little earlier that I had called on the prince on the 6th of November, I did that, but this was before the high tea. It was at that time that I pressed him again for the dinner date. And when he said no, that he said it directly, that was not possible. He put on the basis, "The only place I have been to dinner apart from with the Chinese is with the French. If I accept a dinner from you, then I have to accept so many others. And if you would forgive me, I would like not to." But then he sent a message shortly afterwards that we could come to high tea, which was done on the 20th of November. All the rest of it was...
Did you ever have a Chinese over for an informal type dinner, or a few that you had just gotten to know?
No, the closest we came to that was something developed. This was sometime in 1980 that we needed to discuss, and I called Han Shu to see if it would be possible for him and Ji Jiaoju to come to lunch with just Dave Roy and myself. And we could discuss this matter over an informal lunch. This was in the morning. And then Mr. Ji called back and said, yes, they would come. But since they wouldn't have the necessary paper, would I make sure they could get in? BLA would have blocked them otherwise. So that the Chinese as such, no, that never happened. Mm-hmm. Even if had it happened, would it become formal, really? Equivalent of formal. Now, that happened with staff. John Thompson, in particular. There were many, many exchanges. And others. I think it happened with David Reese.
With his partners, with his equivalents.
I think it happened with his successor.
Of course, they were involved with genuine projects of that involved a lot of cooperation and exchange,
right.
as much as probably anyone in the embassy.
And supposedly with some and not with others. So that... supposedly, Mr. Zhang had the same problem with his colleagues. That the station chief and I had with ours.
Had you gotten your military attachés by now?
Yes. They came very, very soon after normalization. And they were very good. A tremendous asset to the mission.
Yeah, I thought in terms of capabilities they were a mixed lot, but on the whole they were quite good.
Well, their ability to get along with the Chinese was uniformly good.
Mm-hmm.
They had a nice mixture of discretion and pushing to extend the area of involvement, particularly following the ground visit. I was well pleased.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Barbara Watson came. She was then the Assistant Secretary for Consular Affairs. And this was really the beginning of the negotiations for the consular treaty, which was concluded some months later. And I noticed that we went to the Capitol Theater for a performance of Hamlet by the Old Vic Company. It was big Chinese audience, and obviously well able to follow the lines. National Newspaper Alliance with many important editors. President of Drevo, Mr. Thornbeck.
Big Carter supporters, Drevo Corporation.
Were they?
Yeah, good company.
Robert Hsu, of course, by this time had joined them as their Peking representative. Radio Free Europe had a man who came to Peking and recorded an interview with me. And I have Johnson Lee and daughter. Johnson Lee was a Chinese American whose family had come, were in Kunming, and he'd gone to Kunming to. He had four brothers living in Kunming. He had a very pessimistic view of the Chinese future. His brothers were professionals of one kind or another, but supposedly having told him that I'll be doing the same thing 20 years from now I'm doing today, no matter how well I do it, it makes no difference. I'm just as well off if I do it badly. He was very critical of the environmental practices around Kunming. But he'd also made had a proposal for building housing. And asked it with the if I would give him a note, possibly he could get to see Deng Xiaoping. Well, I said that's extremely unlikely, but he did get to see someone in Deng Xiaoping's office.
For what purpose?
To talk about this project of his.
Uh-huh.
But as far as I know, nothing ever developed with regard to it. Frank Gibney.
Encyclopedia Britannica.
And on this occasion, I think it was the first time he told me about the project that they were negotiating with the Chinese for the development of the translation of the Britannica for the Chinese purposes, which I guess is still
going forward.
And in which apparently they except on certain things political. They had a wide range of editorial authority. That's a call by the Ugandan ambassador. I remember that only because he made such an impassioned plea for it. American assistance. They were having such a difficult time.
Now, by now, the Iranian crisis was full upon the United States. By November.
Must have been.
We'll have to pick that up at some point. Did you go in at any point on requesting Chinese assistance?
Yes. Of it yet. But on Thanksgiving Day, 1979, November 22, we had dinner at the residence for 60-odd. What we tried to do was to determine all the Americans who would be in Peking on Thanksgiving Day. Those who had representational quarters like the DCM and the section chiefs would take who they could, and then we would take all that were left and invite them.
And this extend to the students at Peking University and things like that?
Yes.
Huh.
Yes. And they were very joyous affairs.
Sharon is such a gracious hostess on an occasion such as that.
Then we went down to Hong Kong and on our way to Thailand. Mort Abramovitz had been gracious enough to invite me. He thought it was good that the ambassador in China should have a direct knowledge of what was going on in Thailand, particularly in the refugee camps, and to meet with the Thai leadership. And on the day I got there, which was on November 26th, there was the luncheon that Mort and Sheppy gave. It was at that luncheon that I was told about the Thai ambassador in Peking, this was by General Prem, I think it was, who's now the Prime Minister,
right.
would be removed. Then I went over to get a Supreme Command briefing from the Thai military. Most noteworthy of that was that when I inquired what was their understanding of what Deng Xiaoping meant, when he said, if the Vietnamese invade you, we will stand at your side. The briefer gave me a big smile and said, we think he said that to mean the same thing that your president says when he said we will invoke the Manila Pact. You both hope by saying it will never happen. Then there was a dinner at the residence that night where many diplomats, including the Chinese and others, were involved. And then we went the next day, left by air. We went to the new refugee center at Cao Yi Dang, which was about 24 miles, about 40 kilometers in from the border, and to which they were just beginning to bring people. And at this stage, it was quite well organized. And then we went to Nong Samet, which had christened itself Camp 007. Mul Sari, who identified himself with the Khmer Serai, was one of the three who were supposedly the leaders, and he was clearly in charge. The place was crowded. And I asked, how many occupants are there, do you know? He pulled out his sheet from his inside pocket. This is my daily report, he said. Population, 207,194. And flies everywhere. Then we went into Aranya Prathet for lunch and then drove.
Was Sharon with you on this trip?
Yes. We then went to saw Kao, I think, K-A-E-O. And this is the place where Mrs. Carter had been. And it was newly established then. It was essentially a Khmer Rouge camp. There were 30,000, including 2,000 Khmer of Chinese extraction who had been separated because there had been fights. We were there about 5 weeks after its establishment and about 4 weeks after Mrs. Carter had been there when it was in terrible shape. It was very orderly. One of the things that had been said about the Khmer Rouge was that they wouldn't allow them to have children. There were children, kids all over the place. And playing, apparently quite happy. Extreme discipline. But this also was well in from the border. And one asks oneself, well, they must have a way of keeping discipline simply by sheer terror. Because in the daytime, they certainly had access to Thai military, Thai soldiers. They knew about Cao Yi Dang because we asked some of them. So they knew that all they had to do was say, we want to go. And they would have been taken without question. So I think it I always thought it was simplistic to think the Khmer Rouge hold was simply because by terror. It just would be unable to be maintained in that kind of setting. The Chinese were separated, but